and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for this Friday, March 12th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. Taking a look at today's front page story, we continue with a series on a year of COVID-19 in Iowa. As it has been progressing since Sunday, today, consumer future. Some pandemic workarounds here to stay. Businesses branch out with more online delivery options. This is reported by John Stepp of the Gazette. Sometimes these days, Niali Sylvan is finding books for an 8-year-old completely obsessed with water. Other times, she's seeking books for a fan of some, but not all, of fiction writer John Irving's novels. Before 2020, customers looking for books would have visited her store, the Haunted Bookshop, on the north side of Iowa City, and sought her guidance. But in the past year of the pandemic, customers haven't been allowed to personally peruse the 50,000 books on the shelves of the 10-room, 174-year-old building. Instead, Sylvan offers them surprise me bags. Customers can email her with budget interests and phone number, and she uses her expertise to select books for them. She said, "What people love about browsing in bookstores is serenity. They get really excited when they come across something they didn't know they wanted and absolutely have to have. So we try to replicate that experience by providing them with a bag of things they didn't expect." It's one of the many adaptations business owners needed to make over the past year because of COVID-19. Though born quickly out of necessity, some of the ideas have proved more successful than imagined and now are likely to stick around even after the pandemic subsides. Sylvan has sent the surprise bags across the country from California to Ohio to Texas. "You would not believe how popular this has been," she said. She's far from the only business owner to find some successes in online forms of selling and marketing products during the pandemic. Steve Shriver, who owns or co-owns Bruhemia, SoCo Outfitters, Ecolips, and two other Cedar Rapids companies, said all of his businesses have brought a laser-like focus on online and social media marketing. "Coming out of COVID, all of our businesses will be stronger because we're going to be better marketers," he said. SoCo Outfitters, an outdoors retailer that previously relied on in-person sales at its location in Czech Village, added an online store and became an online competitor, just like everyone else, Shriver said. "That will absolutely stick around," he said. "Now we're selling products from the East to West Coast and servicing Cedar Rapids." Stores that had websites put considerable time into improving them when the pandemic hit. The Haunted Bookshop added about 5,000 books to its online inventory, Sylvan said. The second-hand bookstore also posts pictures of some books for sale on Facebook. The Iowa Economic Development Authority has taken note of the need for small businesses to have a bolstered online presence. IEDA launched the Shop Iowa website in August to help brick-and-mortar stores adjust to the changing retail environment. "Looking back at COVID, I think it was one of the best things we did and implemented," Authority Director Debbie Durham said. About 450 businesses from 91 counties use the Shop Iowa online platform. The goal is to have all 99 of the state's counties represented there. "In time, we hope that all of them will begin to develop their own online presence," said Durham, who also leads the Iowa Finance Authority. "We want to see people graduate from it." Durham said IEDA extended a contract with Marion-based website developer Member Marketplace for another 2 years. The agency will continue to evaluate whether to extend the deal more past 2023. Many restaurants, grocery stores, and retailers have turned even more heavily to pickup and delivery services to reach customers who were staying close to home or were forbidden under emergency health orders from being inside their businesses. Hy-Vee, for instance, unveiled Hy-Vee Plus in December, offering delivery, 2-hour express pickup, and other benefits for $99 per year. Bruhemia, Shriver's coffee shop in the new Bohemia neighborhood of Cedar Rapids, is available on several ordering and delivery services. It comes at an increased cost, though. DoorDash and Grubhub take significant commissions on their orders, Shriver said. He recommended his local customers order there either through Chomp, which was founded by 19 restaurant owners in Iowa City, or Bohemia's website for the lowest prices. We've just had to increase our prices on Grubhub and DoorDash to accommodate that high commission, Shriver said. SoCo Outfitters also uses Chomp. Shriver said, allowing nearby customers to have products delivered quickly. We can deliver you goods faster than Amazon, Shriver said. Literally, if you call the store and you need a headlamp or a tent or a jacket, we can have that to you in an hour. Shriver also credited local government with providing more flexibility with outdoor dining, another adaption he anticipates continuing at Bohemia. Outside of retail, Coralville-based gymnastics studio Iowa Gym Nest probably will continue its virtual gymnastics lessons, owner Paige Roth said. Like Shriver and Sylvan, Roth has tapped into business from outside eastern Iowa. There's a lot of things that we can be creative and work on at home, Roth said. We'll have Mom and Dad put down like a tape line on the floor, and that'll be our balance beam. And you'd be surprised how many kids have tumbling mats at home. Business adaptations that could become part of the new normal stretch well beyond consumer-facing industries. Durham sees a more flexible work week and remote working as being here to stay. We all learn that we can be more accommodating because they have less lives, have lives with kids and other things as well, Durham said. IEDA and IFA are working on a policy for remote work among their own employees, Durham said, that includes standards such as minimum internet speeds and privacy rules. In COVID, we were all forced into remote working, Durham said. Now we're going to be a little more deliberate about it. These adaptations alone often are not perfect solutions, though. Sylvan said even with the flurry of surprise me bags, overall business is down about half. I'm not going to lie, Sylvan said. It would be really nice to have people back. Finances aside, customers miss the cats at the haunted bookshop, Sylvan said. She's looking forward to when the customers can visit them, and also a new addition after the pandemic eases. The cranky, childless, grumpy old owner of the bookstore is going to have a new baby, Sylvan said. There will be a new, very tiny staff member. The article is accompanied by several pictures, one of the front of the familiar, more than a century old house of the called the Haunted Bookstore, bookshop, and there's a copy of the owner, and also a copy of a sample bag of Surprise Me books. In this case, it looks like an array of children's picture books. And another local story on the front page, reported by Marissa Payne from Cedar Rapids, tension in Wellington Heights after delayed vote. A dispute over a postponed election for leadership of the Wellington Heights Neighborhood Association has resulted in the former president's ouster, stirring new debates and reviving old ones as residents try to strike a balance between honoring the neighborhood's history and pushing for a progressive evolution. Members this week elected local developer Eric Gutschmidt as president of the city's oldest neighborhood association, the organization that connects its residents with city resources. He ran unopposed after the group's board members unanimously removed former President Bob Grafton from his seat, citing his abrupt rescheduling of a February 9 meeting, where the eligible voters were to elect new leaders, sparking outcry from residents who felt they were being denied a vote. I think now that we're kind of entering a unique time where more progressive leadership is necessary and is called for, said Gutschmidt, who owns and leases property in Wellington Heights but doesn't live in the neighborhood. Before voting occurred Tuesday, board members shared minutes from the February 25 meeting where they voted Grafton out. According to the group's rationale, Grafton demonstrated a lack of accountability to the board for decisions made on behalf of the group, canceled the leadership election without consulting the board, did not notify the board of a news story regarding the postponed election, founded a separate organization with similar goals to the association, and ignored requests to provide sensitive financial information to the association's board. Grafton, who said he served for 2 years as president, 4 years in other board roles, and 2 years in an alternate role, in an interview, disputed these claims and said he felt blindsided by his removal. He said he advocated for an in-person voting option and to use an online voting platform to facilitate the election during a longer 24 to 48-hour voting period to include those who work multiple jobs or late shifts. With COVID-19 precautions in place and much activity taking place online, Grafton said this also created difficulty of verifying voter eligibility. Voters must live, work, or own property in the Southeast Cedar Rapids neighborhood, which is in a low-income census tract and has a racially and ethnically diverse population. Amid fury over the postponed election, Linn County Supervisor Stacy Walker of Cedar Rapids City Council member and Ashley Vinorney, along with local advocates Ture Morrow and Tamara Marcus, submitted a letter February 19 to the Neighborhood Association requesting that a new election be scheduled without delay. The association has done an incredible job of building a positive reputation within the Cedar Rapids community, and we fear that these recent decisions may severely impact the trust in this organization, the letter stated. While we understand that there may be concerns about the inaccessibility of the election, you were using a method supported by advocates amid increased participation. The abrupt postponement was not communicated to the public in advance by board members, who Grafton says were tasked with doing so, he told the Gazette, contradicting the board members' claim they also were not informed. I grew up poor. I know how it is to struggle and not have resources and opportunities, Grafton said. That is why I felt the voting was not inclusive. It was more exclusive. Grafton said there has been animosity toward him stemming from the perception by some voters that he delayed the election to retain power. I just wanted to make my neighborhood that I lived in for 36 years better and bring people along with me, and I was looking forward to another 6 years of doing that, Grafton said. He raised concerns in a February 22 letter to the Cedar Rapids City Council and city manager about Vinorney's friendship with Goodschmidt and their potential optics of her motives for signing onto the letter sent days earlier to the association. In the message, he took issue with a May 2020 request from Goodschmidt to the city to rezone a lot at 1725 4th Avenue Southeast to build a duplex. Vinorney and council member Scott Olson were the only members supporting the request, with the rest of the 9-member council voting to deny it. There were concerns expressed it was too dense for the neighborhood, did not conform to neighborhood design, and would take up parking along that street. At the time the rezoning request was made, Grafton sent a letter to the city opposing it. Philip Platts, now vice president of the association and acting president after Grafton's ouster, was among several community members and association board members supporting the rezoning. Although Grafton mentioned the rezoning in his letter to the council, he said it would be speculation to assume that drove board members' decisions to remove him from his post. Vinorney said the rezoning request was not a factor in her signing onto the letter, but rather it was concerned constituents who reached out. They were asking for this to happen and not being heard, and that is a matter I take personally, and that is the start and the finish of why I was involved with all the neighborhoods association that was outside of my district, she said. Vinorney represents Council District 5, which is largely to the south and southwest of Wellington Heights. Goodschmidt said the rezoning request did not play a role in his decision to run for the presidency. My personal passion for Wellington Heights is certainly separate from my business interest in Wellington Heights, Goodschmidt said. Grafton is a preservationist at heart, who did a great job of stewarding the neighborhood and its association during his tenure, Goodschmidt said. As a landlord and developer who owns several properties in the neighborhood, Goodschmidt said he has often had to disassemble people's negative belief that Wellington Heights is a crime-ridden neighborhood. It is a great mixed-income urban neighborhood that's close to parks and the hospitals downtown, Goodschmidt said. Council member Dale Todd, who represents District 3 that includes Wellington Heights and who once led the Neighborhood Association, told those in attendance that at Tuesday's meeting that he would challenge residents to engage in working on issues affecting Wellington Heights. Neighborhoods and neighborhood associations go through cycles, and you're going through one. There are good times and there are bad times, but I don't have to tell you all that there is a lot of work to do, Todd said. Because of the rich history of this association, we were the leaders. We were the ones that other associations aspired to be. I want to see us back in that position. But the article is accompanied by pictures of two city council members, Ashley Vanorney and Dale Todd, and there is a picture with a caption. I'll read the caption. Eric Goodschmidt, on January 10 of 2019, shows the front room at the historic Perkins House on 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids that he purchased in 2017 and was restoring. Goodschmidt earlier this week was elected president of the Wellington Heights Neighborhood Association. The picture is taken by Liz Martin of the Gazette, and the picture shows Goodschmidt standing in an empty room with, it looks like a curved wall with three windows, a very attractive looking house, as it must be. And now we turn to the Iowa Today page. St. Patrick's Day Parade will be drive-by this year, reported by Diana Nolan. Spectators, start your engines. Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. is the public's chance to drive around the Hawkeye Downs racetrack in southwest Cedar Rapids and see this year's St. Patrick's Day Parade entries, but don't expect to be revving or racing. Vehicles will be crawling along behind St. Patrick, also known as Steve Bryant of Cedar Rapids. Sapada Paso signs and convertibles carrying the group's 2020-2021 Colleen Rebecca Hinks of Center Point, Sapada Paso President Lisa Dalizel of Cedar Rapids, and Cedar Rapids Mayor Brad Hart. The all-volunteer St. Patrick's Day Parade Society, that's known as Sapada Paso, is carrying on a tradition in an untraditional way. It's the group's 46th parade, but the first time it won't be snaking around downtown Cedar Rapids, thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic that shut down last year's event less than a week before its March 17 rollout. We were the first big event in Cedar Rapids to cancel, Dalizel said. We were really worried about having it because easily 50,000 people attend, and if it's a nice day, we've had up to 100,000 downtown. Group members braced themselves for backlash. Quote, because the parade is a staple in Cedar Rapids, Dalzell said. I really appreciate the folks who actually gave our volunteer group grace for having to make the decision. They also knew they couldn't cancel 2 years in a row. That's when we came up with the idea of what to do. A drive-through parade, she said. Instead of the usual mix of 100 marching units, floats, music, animals, and vehicles on the move, this year's spectators will do the driving as they slowly move past about 30 floats parked in the racetrack's infield. No one will be tossing candy, but the first 200 vehicles to enter the track will receive a swag bag bursting with candy, cups, magnets, chips, clips, lanyards, and a few with gift certificates. All vehicles will be handed a ballot so occupants can vote for the new People's Choice Award. Judges will decide on the other awards, ranging from most creative to best adaptation of a walking entry, to be handed out on the track after the parade. The traditional after party is another COVID casualty. The biggest goal that we had this year was to keep Sapada Paso relevant, Dalizel said, and provide this event in the true form of tradition, knowing it's completely different. The article is accompanied by a picture, and I'll read the caption. Liz Colony uses textured spray to paint spray paint to create a small-scale cardboard Stonehenge replica while working on the Fong's Pizza Sapada Paso Parade floats Thursday at her home in Swisher. the photo is taken by Gazette photographer Liz Martin, and it has a small section called At a Glance. It's the Sapa da Paso St. Patrick's Drive-By Parade on Saturday, 2 to 4 p.m. on the racetrack at Hawkeye Downs, 4400 6th Street Southwest, Cedar Rapids. Circle the track in your vehicle to view stationary parade entries. The cost is free, and you can vote for the People's Choice Award and entry, and you get a swag bag for the first 200 vehicles. On TV, see KCRG film on channel 9.2 at 1 p.m. March 17, at 7 p.m. March 18, March 30th, and April 1st, and noon on April 11th. You can see the website regarding this at sapadapaso.org. And now we turn to the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial, Projects Deserve Funding. Cedar Rapids is seeking $39.5 million in state funds to help fuel a half dozen development and outdoor recreation projects in the downtown area, totaling $261 million. The funds would come through the state's Reinvestment District Program, which steers hotel, motel, and sales taxes generated in communities into, quote, transformational development, unquote, projects. There's $100 million available, and 10 applicants have submitted more than $200 million in requests. The competition will be tough, but we believe the Cedar Rapids proposal deserves funding. Yes, Cedar Rapids' request is the largest, but more than half of the other applications come from central Iowa, including five in the Des Moines Metro, totaling $97.5 million, and a $21.4 million request from Ames for a hotel and convention center project. During the first round of reinvestment district grants in 2014 and 2015, Des Moines received the largest award, $36 million, for a list of projects in the downtown area. Officials say geographic balance may be a factor in scoring the projects, which is good news. And we're not suggesting Cedar Rapids' bid should be funded simply because it's our turn. These are high-quality development projects that would transform and enhance the city's core and build on major investments made since the flood of 2008. Included in the application is First and First West, which seeks to bring a Big Grove brewery, other commercial businesses, and housing to the site once slated for a Cedar Rapids casino. The hotels at Guarantee Bank, with the renovation of the historic building into one of two hotels on the site, is on the list. The 25-story high-rise at Paramount, with housing, a grocery store, and rooftop restaurant, is included as well as efforts to develop green space and outdoor recreation at the 8th Avenue pump station. A plaza on 4th Street Southeast and a 5-in-1 dam river bypass channel also are included in the application. It's a broad array of projects that could draw people downtown to live, take in entertainment venues, grab a meal, or enjoy recreational opportunities. After a year marked by a pandemic and a derecho, these ambitious plans are particularly appealing. Projects that score 70 points or higher on the Economic Development Authority's scoring formula will present their projects to the IEDA board, which has the final say on who gets funding and how much. We believe Cedar Rapids will make the cut, and we urge the board to make an investment in a resilient city looking to the future. That's today's Gazette editorial. And we have a column by Adam Sullivan at Liberty, Front Plates Canceled, Dems Cry. If you're not a cop or a car enthusiast, you might not know about the fierce debate over front license plates. Most states, including Iowa, require most vehicles to display two plates, one on the front and one on the back. Police say they're a necessary tool for catching bad guys, while gearheads say they look bad on classic cars. It is hardly a top issue of the day, but lawmakers' recent debate on it was illuminating. Iowa Democrats continued their bizarre embrace of aggressive and counterproductive tough-on-crime policies, even stooping to defend prison labor. Legislators are considering a bill to make modest changes to Iowa's license plate requirements. Senate File 419 would allow certain specialty vehicles to carry a front plate inside the vehicle rather than displaying it. It also would restrict failure to post a front plate to a secondary offense, meaning police couldn't pull drivers over for that reason alone. The legislation passed the Iowa Senate this week, mostly along party lines, with Republicans in support and Democrats opposed. Democrats pulled out a long and strange list of objections. Advocates for universal front license plates said the bill would harm manufacturing workers, including those who are incarcerated. Inmates stay busy producing these license plates. That could affect keeping them busy, so it's inmate jobs and manufacturing jobs, said Todd Taylor, Democrat, Cedar Rapids. The business protectionism is bad, but it's the proud embrace of underpaid captive labor that really sets it off for me. Either way, Taylor was wrong. The proposal requires just as many license plates to be made, so his treasured prison labor should be unaffected. Critics of the bill said it would hamstring police officers, who occasionally rely on front license plates to track suspected criminals, State Senator Kevin Kinney, Democrat Oxford, said of its handcuffing the ability of law enforcement to do its job. The bill they oppose would reduce primary traffic stops by police officers which are associated with racially biased policing. Cities such as my hometown of Iowa City are taking steps to cut down on primary stops as a way to combat racial disproportionality in police encounters. One lawmaker called it cancel culture to take away front plates, but the legislation would allow anyone who likes their front license plate to keep their front license plate. The industrial conglomerate 3M, which is based in Minnesota and has interests in Iowa, partners with law enforcement groups to defend front license plate. It also happens to be a major seller of license plate materials and accessories. The Front Plate Campaign, it's spelled FRNTPL8, a collaboration between 3M and police lobbyists, plainly characterizes it as a policing for profit scheme. Toll enforcement and parking garage fees are negatively impacted in states requiring rear plates only. But the bill in Iowa is extremely narrow, more of a small kickback for hobbyists than a meaningful policy change. All cars will still have two license plates, and most will display them on front and back to detractors that somehow is seen as an attack on police. Democrats have a reputation for being progressive on law enforcement reform. In Iowa, they're looking their damnedest to make sure that reputation is unearned. That was Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column today. And we have one letter to the editor submitted by Ellen Ballas of Iowa City. Representative Miller Meek's votes keep Iowans in poverty. U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks voted to oppose COVID economic relief for Iowans. The American Rescue Plan Act, H.R. 1319, included a minimum wage hike that did not survive final passage, but her intransigence and insensitivity on both issues are on full display. She also voted against advancing the budget, then falsely claimed partisan issues such as a national $15 an hour minimum wage, which would kill thousands of jobs across the country and in southeastern Iowa. This is not a partisan issue. The U.S. Department of Labor documents the creation of a minimum wage under FDR in 1938. Since then, only four U.S. presidents did not increase it: Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. Both presidents, George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, Republicans, signed a wage hike into law. History matters. By design, a gradual wage increase reduces the shock to employers. Estimates are 900,000 would be lifted from poverty. Half of all jobs lost during the pandemic are low wages. poor working conditions put low-wage workers at a higher risk for infection. If they don't show up for work, they don't get paid. Moreover, as Miller Meeks continues to stonewall, she's pushing more Iowans below the poverty line. That was the loan letter submitted to the Gazette on the inside page. That was by Ellen Ballas of Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Friday, March 12th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Among our other and shorter notices, from Anamosa, Teresa Court, 88, died Wednesday, March 10, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Center, Marion. Cedar Rapids, Alice Jane Stegman, 88, died Wednesday, March 10th, Tehan Funeral Home. Hazleton, Deborah L. Thomas, 62, died Wednesday, March 10th, Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home, Olwine. Lamont, Laverne Virgil Tinkley, 87, died Thursday, March 11th, the Leonard Muller Funeral Home and Crematory, Manchester. And they have one more item. Ben Wright Sr., 95, of Mission, Texas, died Wednesday, March 10th, the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Now, among our regular notices, we have a Richard A., known as Dick McKean, 87, died peacefully Tuesday, March 9, at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Funeral services, 1 p.m. Monday, March 15, at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City, with Father Ed Fitzpatrick officiating. Visitation will be Sunday, 1 to 3 p.m. at the funeral home. Burial will be at Memory Gardens Cemetery. The service may be viewed on Zoom, and the link may be found on Dick's obituary page at the Lansing Funeral Home website under Tribute Wall. We have Robert A. Jayne, J-A-Y-N-E, of Center Point, 84, died at his home on Wednesday, March 10th. Private family service at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website under the obituary for Robert Jayne under the video tab, and that will start at 11 a.m. on Monday. Burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. There will be a visitation on Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. From Clarence, Gordon R. Bengi, I'm going to spell that B-E-N-G-E, Bengi, George R. Bengi, known as Gordy. He died on March 6th at the age of 76. Celebration of life will be held on his birthday, June 16th. Bloomfield, Michelle Eileen Cruiser, 44, passed away on March 8th at the Davis County Hospital. Michelle's wish was to be cremated. Celebration of life for family and friends will be held at a later date. A memorial has been established to her family and may be mailed to 22776 195th Street, Bloomfield, 52537. The Wagler Funeral Home in Bloomfield is in charge of arrangements and online condolences for in behalf of Michelle Eileen Cruiser may be directed to waglerfuneralhome.com. From Tipton, Aunt John Andrew Zaruba, 94, died suddenly on Tuesday, March 9th, with loving family at his side. On Saturday, March 13, Fry Funeral Home will be hosting a noon visitation followed by a celebration of life service at 1 p.m. In memory of John, a memorial fund has been established in his name. Cards and memorials may be mailed to Joyce Zaruba at 1924 Highway 38, Tipton, 52772. Online condolences may be shared on the same website where you may view John's complete obituary, fryfuneralhome.com. That was for John Andrew Zaruba of Tipton. From Monticello, Sarah Bradley, 75, died Wednesday, March 10th at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital, Cedar Rapids, following a brief illness. Private family services will be held at the Getz Funeral Home Monticello, Interment, Sacred Heart Cemetery. Father Paul Baldwin will officiate at the services. You may sign the guest book or leave a condolence for the family at GetzOnline.com. From Rowley, Elaine K. Agu, 77, died on Friday, March 5th at Prairie Hills Assisted Living in Independence, Iowa. Celebration of life will be held at noon on May 8th at the Rowley Community Center in Rowley, Iowa. Her cremated remains will be buried in Rowley Cemetery in Rowley. White Funeral Home of Independence is in charge of arrangements for Elaine K. Agu, and you may leave condolences at white-monthope.com. Gabrielle L. Devereaux of Walker died on March 6th. Memorial service will be held 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 13, with a visitation 1 hour prior at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Gabrielle L. Devereaux under Photos and Videos or Media, starting at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 13th. From Dysart, Helen May Wieben died on Wednesday, March 10th at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home at the age of 86. Memorials may be directed to Zion Lutheran Church in Dysart, the Dysart Museum, or Cedar Valley Hospice. Visitation on Saturday, March 13, 3 to 6 p.m. at Zion Lutheran Church in Dysart and an hour before service. The service will be on Sunday, March 14, 2 p.m. at Zion Lutheran Church, Dysart, and Overton Funeral Home Dysart is handling arrangements for Helen May Wieben of Dysart. Condolences may be left at overtonfuneralhomes.com. And we have one more. It's Corrine K. Coquelette Dolezel of Dallas, Iowa, died on March 9th at Mercy Hospital in Des Moines after an eight-month battle with large B-cell lymphoma. Private family services for Corrine K. Dolezel will be held at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery at Adel, Iowa, and condolences may be sent to the family at 1993 60th Avenue, Dallas, Iowa, 50062. That's for Corrine K. Coquelette Dolezel. Then we turn to sports, the Iowa State boys basketball. Just a mutual respect. Lynx Braves have only admiration heading into Class 1A title tilt. This is written by Jeff Johnson, and it's from Des Moines. There is no hidden acrimony anywhere here between these teams, players and coaches, just mutual respect. That's pretty cool. Northland coach Mike Hilmer spoke the other day about his admiration for Trey Shearer. Montezuma's All-State guard expressed that admiration right back in a similarly unprompted manner. I knew Austin and Jake a little bit, Shearer said of Mike's sons, Jake, the former Iowa Mr. Basketball, and Austin, the junior starting point guard. I wouldn't say I'm friends with Mike, but Mike and I know each other. He has known my family for a little while, so yeah, we're pretty acquainted, and they're great people. North Lynn and Montezuma square off today at noon for the Class 1A state championship. This might just be the perfect example of a bunch of quality folks on both sides being rewarded for being quality folks. It's the fourth straight year North Lynn, now at 27-0, is playing for it all. The Lynx won the Class 2A championship in 2019 and were runners-up last season in 2A and 2018 in 1A. North Lynn is 134-3 over these four seasons. Honestly, all it means is I've been fortunate to coach a lot of good kids, Coach Hilmer said. I told these guys since day one that I am a big believer that good things happen to good kids. I said, there's a reason you guys continue to win, because there are other kids who deserve to win. Maybe there's not as many on other teams, I don't know. But if you go to our school building, you wouldn't even know we have a state tournament team. Our kids aren't going to brag about how good they are. You can see it in this team. Nobody cares who scores the points. They're all smiles. Montezuma, 24-2, qualified for the state tournament for the third year in a row. It finished fourth in 1A in 2019 and third last season. There are 147 teams in the state in 1A, and there are so many good, talented teams that deserve it just as much as we do, Montezuma's coach Cole Watts said. They've worked hard. They put in the hours to get to this moment, where there are two teams left. It's an amazing feeling. I don't know about the boys, but for me, relief is the right word. 100%, Montezuma coach Derek Dengler said. I've been so fortunate as a coach to just have great kids. We've been here in these spots the last 2 years and competed in both of those games, but fell short. So to finally be able to get one, to get these guys an opportunity to play on Friday, is awesome. The article is accompanied by an overhead picture looking down through the basket at looks like five of the players in action, and I'll read the caption: North Lynn's Dylan Kurt, 22, and Martinsdale St. Mary's Carson Elbert struggle for a rebound during a Class 1A boys state semifinal Wednesday at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. The article is provided by Andy Abeta of the Gazette. And today's game, as was mentioned, is between North Lynn, 27-0, versus number 7, Montezuma, in Class 1A, boys basketball. Montezuma's got a record of 42-2. That game will be at noon. The other games that are scheduled are in the Class 2A championship, number 1, Boyden Hull, versus number 3, Western Christian. That's at 2:30. Class 3A championship, number 1, Huxley Ballard versus number 5, Pella at 5 p.m. And the 4A championship, number 4, Johnston versus number 2, Waukee. That's at 7:30. And now we go back to the main section of the paper. Iowa City may try again on Reconciliation Commission. This is reported by Lee Hermiston. With a third of its members having resigned in the past week, the Iowa City Council on Tuesday will weigh temporarily suspending the city's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Based on observations of the TRC's meetings and recent resignations of TRC members and the TRC's chosen facilitator, the City Council believes it is in the best interests of the city to temporarily suspend the operation of the TRC pending further discussion and action by the City Council, the proposed resolution reads. The City Council is scheduled to discuss the Commission during its work session and formal meeting. The public will have a chance to weigh in during the public meeting. Tuesday's discussion comes at the request of Mayor Bruce Teague, who addressed the Commission at the beginning of its March 4 meeting ahead of a planned vote of no confidence in the Commission's leadership. During the contentious meeting, Chairwoman Roysann Porter resigned from her leadership role before the no confidence vote. Vice Chair Shaylen Harrington briefly assumed the chairperson role before her ouster. Commission members acknowledged the group had experienced turmoil during its first 6 meetings, but Porter was singled out for creating an unwelcoming environment in the meetings. The former chairwoman was accused of telling a community member to get over the June protest in which demonstrators were tear-gassed and with having a hostile conversation with a member of the public following his criticism of a commission meeting. Commissioner Mohamed Traore was selected as the new chair and Amel Ali was selected as vice chair during the meeting. In the days that followed, Commissioner Anthony Curran, Porter, and Harrington all resigned from the commission. Jesse Case, who had been hired as a facilitator for the commission, also resigned. In his letter of resignation, Case outlined 3 potential courses of action for the City Council to consider. reconfigure the current commission by adding more members, establish ground rules for meetings, provide training and orientation for commission members, and clearly define the role of the new facilitator. Disband the commission and reform it with a criteria-based selection process for commissioners, applicant interviews, and training for new commissioners. Issue a request for proposals from nonprofits or educational organizations to run the commission. Tasked with an enormous responsibility, but provided with no structures or support for carrying it out, it is not surprising that the commission has become paralyzed by what looks like infighting, but what is, in fact, the natural result of the city not yet backing up its resolution with structures and processes that would enable the commission to succeed, Case wrote. Vanessa Miller reports Mount Mercy plans in-person classes in fall. Assuming COVID-19 vaccine will be widely available this summer, Mount Mercy University this week unveiled plans for fully in-person operations by August 1st, reverting to a more normal college experience after hybrid learning this year kept students at least some of the time out of class and confined to Zoom screens. In-person plans for the Cedar Rapids-based private university apply to all work, academic, and student operations. That means residence halls will operate at full capacity, and administrators will assess vaccine adoption rates to determine whether to adjust guest and group gathering policies according to a Mount Mercy message. Although students and employees still may be expected to wear masks throughout the academic year, officials anticipate relaxing social distancing rules after the vaccine is widely available. Mount Mercy is strongly encouraging its employees and students to receive the vaccine when it is available to them, according to the campus communication. The University of Iowa and the University of Northern Iowa also have announced plans for more in-person classes and operations next fall. Iowa State University hasn't yet disclosed its fall plans, and neither have Coe College in Cedar Rapids or Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Although next fall is months away, graduation is coming up later this spring, and like Iowa's public universities, Mount Mercy, Coe, and Cornell all are planning some form of in-person ceremony with online alternatives available for those not comfortable with in-person ceremonies. The plans include Mount Mercy. Students will be split by program into smaller ceremonies at 9 a.m., 11 a.m., 1 p.m., and 3 p.m., May 16th, in the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. Students will be allowed to invite family members to sit in physically distant spaces. Everyone must wear a mask. Co. In-person socially distanced commencement activities, including ringing of the victory bell, will occur May 1st and 2nd. A pre-recorded virtual service is planned for those earning baccalaureate degrees at 11 a.m. May 1st, 9 a.m. May 2nd bell ringing, and 10 a.m. May 2nd commencement on Clark Field. Graduates will be allowed a limited number of guests. Cornell. In-person ceremonies for 2020-2021 graduates will be held rain or shine May 15 and 16 on Van Meter Field at Ash Park. A virtual baccalaureate service will be streamed on Facebook at 3 p.m. May 14th. Commencement for the 2020 graduates will be 1:30 p.m. May 15th, with commencement for the year's graduates at 1:30 p.m. All participants must be masked and follow distancing guidelines, with graduates limited to 2 guests each. Campus COVID testing will be available the week before graduation for seniors, faculty, and staff. Kat Russell reports library receives bequest of $1 million. The Cedar Rapids Public Library has been named the sole beneficiary of an estate that exceeds $1 million, left by a centenarian who once said that books have kind of been my life. Library Director Dara Schmidt said she knew of the bequest from the estate of Nadine E. Sandberg late last summer, but was not informed of the size of the gift until months later. "I'll admit that I had tears in my eyes when I found out about the gift," said Charity Tyler, executive director of the Cedar Rapids Public Library Foundation. The generosity of Mrs. Sandberg was really touching, and knowing that she did it because books have been her life and that she loved to read, it just gave me chills. "It's too early to determine how the library will use the money," Smith said, "but it already is weighing community needs and seeing how it can best fill some of those gaps. We still don't know exactly what the answer to that is, but we know one of the pending issues for the library is that we don't have a permanent location on the west side," Schmidt said. "The Ladd Library is a rental space. The need there is not an immediate, or our lease is good until 2027. But creating a permanent space for the Ladd Library and our partners is definitely something we want to consider. The next step," Schmidt said, "is to do a feasibility study. We're already working with our partners and the city because we want to ensure that whatever vision we have for service on the west side meets their vision for service on the west side while also meeting the needs of the community," she said. Over the years, the Ladd Library at 3750 Williams Boulevard Southwest has outgrown its role as a small branch of the library to become a community center that has partnered with various organizations to provide resources such as parenting classes, women, infant, and children's clinics, workforce and skill development, and food pantries. There is no arguing that the Ladd Library is not a viable and trusted community resource on the west side. And even when we, Smith said, and even when we look at the last year, at the derecho response, the library was where the neighborhood resource center popped up because people already knew it was someplace safe they could go to get help. So what it looks like right now as a community resource is fantastic, but what it could look like in the future, that's something that is really exciting to consider. Nadine Elizabeth Sandberg grew up in Gilman, Iowa, where she attended school and excelled as a basketball player, according to a news release. After college, she worked for General Electric, where her career included running GE's regional office during the time the company was helping build the Duane Arnold Energy Center. She was married to Charles Sandberg, who died in 1996. They did not have children. Sandberg, who once said, "Books have kind of been my life," died in May at the age of 102, just 2 months before her 103rd birthday. "It's really an incredible gift to the library and to community," Tyler said. And Mrs. Sandberg, like Marilyn Ladd and Ada Van Vechten before her, likely had no real idea when she did it about the number of lives that this kind of gift will touch. Ladd, a former test technician at Rockwell Collins, left the library a gift of almost $750,000 at the time of her death in 2011. At that time, Ladd's gift was the largest the library had ever received from a single individual. Then-director Bob Pasternak told the Gazette. I'm going to cut that article short, and it's basically a couple short paragraphs after that. And you have been listening to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Friday, March 12th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.